Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. This is episode 232 of Yes But Why podcast, my interview with Houston improviser Stephen M. Saltzman. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. In my conversation with Stephen, we go down quite a few philosophical rabbit holes. I'm looking at Audible right now, and they have a ton of philosophy books for you to listen to. You should check it out. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This episode of Yes But Why is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. Podcast Cadet is dedicated to helping you build your podcast. We will connect you to the resources you'll need to get better and better with each and every episode. Swing on by podcastcadet.com to get help for all your podcasting needs. Let us know you heard about us from Yes But Why, and you'll get 20% off the workshop or service you buy. This week on Yes But Why, I talked to Stephen M. Saltzman, co-founder of Pronoia Theater in Houston, Texas. In our chat, we talk about philosophical ideas of identity and what it's like to produce small, independent theater. Support Stephen and his theater community by checking out all the content available at pronoiatheater.com. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 232. Stephen M. Saltzman explores improv, identity, and good life choices. Enjoy! Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
I grew up in a very large family. Entertaining ourselves and each other just was like part of it. It was part and parcel to how we spent time. And so like getting my elder siblings, I have three, there's triplets in my family that are 4.5 years older than me. So like if I could get two or all three of them to laugh, like that was a thrill every time. And then in second grade, around age 7, maybe, I was in a production of Br'er Rabbit. I was given a non-speaking role and I was a very small child. I was an exceedingly small child. And so I was this tiny little rabbit, and the school gave me a prop that was this carrot that admittedly I was a very small child, but was like the size of my forearm and just had the longest green tassels. And yeah, the main thing I did is like somebody came out and they asked me where Br'er Rabbit went and I pointed. But I have such strangely clear memories of the performance night. I don't know if anybody liked it. I don't know if anybody enjoyed it. But being on stage, pointing, having like the prop, the costume, feeling like half silly, half cute, but taking it very seriously, even as a very small child. And one of the oddest memories is the classroom was our green room for that production. And since we were there so late, the smell of the cleaning supplies is like deeply ingrained and tied to theater for me. I don't know what the desk cleaner was, but every once in a while I'll get a whiff of it just like walking around. And it's almost transportational, just whisks me back to being in second grade where I'm like, oh, yeah, well, this is a magic thing happening and I don't understand it. But yeah, I think that non-speaking role in a second grade school production of Br'er Rabbit is certainly the first time I felt like being on stage was something that needed to keep happening.
I like the idea that you were like, I took it very seriously. And yes. I appreciate that. I was a serious kid too.
Oh, I was also a cut-up.
Sure, sure, absolutely. But that's part of it, right? Like if you have the wherewithal to do comedy as a young child, you have to be a little jaded, a little cynical. Like you have to be like a 7-year-old who's like, listen, I get it, guys. And then like you get the adults to laugh, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it helped that I did very well in school. So even when I was disruptive, it was like, come on, Steven. Like, I don't want you to be in trouble, but I have no other choice.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. It's a weird thing, too, because I realize personally, I also did well in school, but I wouldn't consider myself the smartest of my friends by any stretch of the imagination. And so whenever people talk about like their kids or like grades or whatever, I'm like, guys, some people are good at taking those tests and some people aren't. Like some people are good at smiling and the teacher gives them good grades. Like you're not, you know, I wasn't studying all the time. I wasn't applying myself. I have no like serious study habits. You know how they'll bring those back up. Like if you're doing a writing thing, they're like, think back to the study habits you had in school. I'm like, so do nothing and get everything fine. Like that's not a solution. Right. But yeah, I was also a comedy kid too. So I think they were a little like, I don't know, let her do it. She's still going to make A's, you know?
Yeah. One of those creative types. You just gotta let them go.
Did you, what did your family think about you doing theatrical stuff? Did you continue to do, you mentioned earlier that you did choir. Was that after Br'er Rabbit, was that the creative outlet? And was your family very supportive of this?
I actually started choir before. I know I was doing choir in first grade. I don't know if I did it in kindergarten. I don't really remember. Childhood is a mess that I can't remember a ton of. But yeah, I know I was doing it in first grade because my first grade teacher lost her wedding ring the night of our Christmas recital, and I found it in the snow. And she was very grateful.
oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, that's like a screenplay.
Mm-hmm. especially because she then like bought a bunch of... my family didn't have a ton of money, and I helped her find this diamond ring in the snow at night. And so I believe it was her. She wound up buying like Christmas presents for me and some of my siblings. And so on Christmas Day, like we came downstairs and there were more presents than were expected. But it was also like all pens and notebooks and like school supplies, which was still very sweet. It was still very nice. But I was like, oh, these are not the things I expected. So
I love this idea, like clearly a teacher gift.
Yeah. And it's got to be the one who lost her diamond ring in the snow late at night, and her itsy bitsy tiny child student who was only 6 inches from the ground standing straight up was able to find it.
Oh, I had no idea you were a Lilliputian. That's helpful.
Yes. Well, some people said I was a Lilliputian. Others said I was a Yahoo. So.
Well, I'm sure you were adorable. And you were later in the birth order, right? Like you were like fourth or something?
Fifth, because there were the triplets and then one older than them.
Oh, yeah. Like
I was a yawn. Like triplets. I can't compete with the amount of stress that creates, even if I tried.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, identical twin girls and a triplet boy. Extremely rare.
Wow. So how did it continue for you, your creativity? Clearly, you know, you're winning. Your teachers are big fans of you because you can find small objects in the snow. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're doing pretty well. You're doing pretty good grades-wise. You're number 5, so nobody noticed what you were doing at all. But how did you develop creativity? Did your parents say like, yeah, get in there, do your stuff? Or were they like, oh, were you not home and you were just going and doing what you wanted?
Yeah, it was interesting. So I did, like I said, I did choir up until 8th grade. And I dabbled in a tiny bit of required mute instrument playing, but never actually learned an instrument. Kind of regret that now as an adult. I own a violin and several mizmar, which are an Iranian droning instrument that I had to learn how to play a little bit of in Arabian Nights.
You still have those actual instruments?
No, I have some that I got at a later time. Okay. This kept the one that I used for the show. But I didn't realize it. I had learned how to play with a cracked reed.
Oh.
I was like, yeah, it's just hard to get sound out of sometimes. And then I showed somebody who actually knew music. They were like, Steven, you shouldn't be getting sound out of this at all. Like, you've been practicing with a broken instrument. I'm like, well, I didn't know how hard it was supposed to be. Which is probably a very common tale in my life. It's like, I didn't know how hard it was supposed to be, so I just struggled through.
Yeah. How is that a common theme in your life? What are other, what's another tale that has that as the lesson?
Well, one of the things it makes me think of is romantic relationships. I grew up from just having a large family. It was not a very healthy family. There was violence at home. Mm-hmm. And when I grew up, there was violence with my partners, but it wasn't as violent. And so it didn't register as not okay, or at least like not as like completely unacceptable. And so like that's something. And wanting to commit and be committed and like stay with the same person, but not realizing that, frankly, I was like in an abusive relationship.
Ah, yes. Yes, that can happen.
I didn't start seeing a therapist until much later in life, and I was always amused that... I joked that my first therapist, one of the most common things she would say was, oh, wow. I was like, huh, that merits a oh, wow from a mental health professional. Good to know. It's the only life I remember having is this one where I call myself Steven.
Right.
Anything else is just guesswork.
Sure.
Yeah,
I definitely am one of those people, though, that I feel like maybe we had other lives, but, you know, we'll never connect to them truly in this life. But maybe occasionally here and there when you feel something or like you feel connected to something and you're like, there's no reason for me to feel connected to this thing.
Yeah.
I feel like those are like tiny moments that are like connecting you to the other person you are.
Yeah.
That's a weird, random thing.
My brother-in-law was like, what do you think the afterlife is like? I'm like, well, one, I don't know. But I like the idea that it's, we're not even necessarily reincarnated as people, but that there's, for lack of a better term, an experience machine. Mm-hmm. And it can be changed to have different parameters. What we consider the physical constants of the universe don't have to be in the omniverse, so to speak. That there are realities beyond this one potentially. And I've definitely had times where I'm like sitting around, I'm like, I am a grand and ancient being and I'm just here for a minute. And it almost always passes. But like, it's a very curious sensation. Like you were saying, feeling connected to something inexplicably. Mine is often feeling connected to outside of life, if that makes sense.
It does. It definitely does. Especially if you're like not telling, if the beginning of the story isn't like, so I took these hallucinogens. So right. Like, if that's not the case, but you're still feeling connected, that's pretty solid and spiritual, I'd say.
I like it. Yeah. And no, it's like sitting at work. I'll be like, I'm working to make people feel safer, but also like all of this is only for now, but somehow there's a part of me that is not. And it is from outside. And I often wonder, like, what is the connectivity between consciousness and matter? How does it attach itself? We don't know how it's made manifest. We don't know how thinking becomes aware. We haven't replicated it, certainly, other than through, you know, the standard, you know, the biological methods.
Sure.
We haven't been able to replicate it. So where does it come from? And people have had massive brain damage and they're still aware and they're still similar, though sometimes they change, you know, stripped amygdalas and all that. But it's very curious. And I also think about the Ship of Theseus a lot. Like a lot. Are you familiar with the Ship of Theseus?
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's a philosophical mind experiment, and there's a variety of variations on it. And the basic idea is that there's this great king named Theseus, and he has a ship. And his ship, we'll say, has 50 boards. And every year, he finds the worst and oldest and most rotted board, and he removes it and replaces it. Over the course of 50 years, he has replaced every board on his entire ship. Is it still the ship of Theseus? And there, you know, you can answer yes or no. It is the same ship. It isn't the same ship. All of the parts changed, has its identity. And then one of the to it is the idea, like, assume he has a twin brother who every year takes the board and places it exactly where it used to be on the old ship. So now, after 50 years, Theseus has a ship, and his brother has a ship made of all of the old boards of the ship of Theseus in exactly the same place as the old ship of Theseus, and they both claim to have the ship of Theseus, who actually has it. And, you know, you yourself, as an entity, your matter changes. We consume so that we can replace our decaying parts, in part, and also for energy. And the same for myself, and the same for everyone. And there are very small pockets of you that never really change. Inside of your, what is it called? The lens of your eye? The lens of your eye closes, and it doesn't really change. Like, those cells don't change properly, which is why they cloud with age, is they just... They don't really reproduce. You can't grow it back if it gets damaged and such. Inside of most people's corneas, I want to say is the term, but yeah, inside their lens, there's a tiny pocket of fluid that just sits there. It never really changes. There's very little evidence. Like, there's not really blood going to it or from it, so it can't really be changed. And so some parts of you are constant, but the vast majority of you has changed innumerable times in a physical way. And then how many times have you changed as a person, like as who you consider yourself? Would your child self recognize you personality to personality? Certainly there's going to be some overlap, some like, oh yeah, I see where that came from. Natures or playfulness or even like hurts, things that like traumas or injuries as a child that have calcified into something as an adult or coping mechanisms, what have you, all of those can carry through. But how much of you has to survive in order to be the same person?
You know, it's funny. I think about that all the time. And as you're talking, I'm like, oh man, you're just walking me right into saying the same thing I say in every episode. I have an 18-year theory that, that we become different people every 18 years. And so the journey from 0 to 18, 18 to 36, 36 to 54 are journeys of you becoming your new self, right? Now it makes sense, 0 to 18, you know, we're growing up, we're living under the constraints of our parents, blah, blah, blah. We're given the experiences we have because as children, you're not really like choosing your experiences, you're just sort of having them. And then when you get older, you either stick with that or you break away from it. And then you become yourself. Like, you have to go through and change from 18 to 36 to become like an adult and to figure out how to live in the world. Because your parents gave you what they knew, but they only knew their part. And now you have your new part. And then you get older, and usually when I bring this up, I'm bringing it up because I think that we don't give credit to the later stages in our adult lives, and that, like, we give all this glory to the 0 to 18, and then
the 18
to 36 is the demographic of everything. If you want somebody to sell you something, that's who they're trying to sell it to, right? And so everyone over 36 is just like, okay, good luck to you. And there's so many years. And sometimes you get two or three cycles. And I really believe that you become new people. And sometimes you're in the same place. You live in the same town. You have the same job. Sure. But you're still different in the same way that your example about the ship, right? You've gone through new experiences. You have... stuff has happened to you. You change the way you look at the world, right? It will happen, whether you plan it or not. It's happening, right?
Yeah.
You're going through it. And in the same way that, like, I've talked to people of all different ages, right? And sometimes I can guess how old they are based on where their angst is. Like, it's like, because the pattern of angst is the same,
yeah,
right? And also, I try to do it as a give yourself a break, which is to say, I'll say things like, you're not going to be mad at a five-year-old for not knowing what they're going to college for. And you're not. Yeah. So in the same way, a person who's, 36 plus 5 is 41. 41-year-olds kind of floundering, doesn't really know what they're doing with their life. Give them a break. They got a while to figure out who middle-aged them is. Let them figure it out. They'll do it. It'll be all right. You know what I mean? Like, this idea of letting the journey happen, of being in the flow with it, of being being kind to yourself,
yeah,
to have that journey. I'm a big proponent of that kind of thing. So when you brought that up, I was like, oh man, I always try not to bring it up because I literally talk about this podcast should just be changed to Amy's 18-year theory. Like, that's what it's called. Because that's,
I have two major thoughts on it.
Tell me.
So one, you mentioned that, like, you're on the journey. It's going to happen. One of the things that I try to focus on and think, and I wind up thinking about a lot, is like, you are going to change. Kind of like what you're saying. It's going to happen. I think that one of our duties is to pay attention to how we're changing, because if you don't take care about who you're going to become, you may wind up being someone you never wanted to be.
Mm.
Not that you need to be stressed all the time. Part of this taking care of it is also relaxing. I was dating someone a while back, and he was starting to go into grad school, and he was teaching classes. And one of the things we talked about is like nurturing people to, when they're making a choice, asking themselves, is this the pattern of behavior I want to reinforce? And that pattern of behavior doesn't have to be a constant. You know, if I want to work, that is part of the pattern. If I want to take a break when I am stressed, that is part of the pattern, even though it may be the exception. You know, if I have five ones before a zero and then five ones and then a zero, it's still a pattern. And that zero is essential, right? Taking that break, taking that time.
I do like this idea of keeping in mind, like, where you're going on your path. And you know what? It reminded me what I forgot about, like, before we even started recording. We were talking about living a life of regrets, that people are always talking to you about your regrets and what you should not do. And while I think that sometimes that can be detrimental to children because, like, they don't know what to regret, when you're over 18, you know what to regret. So you keep your eyes out for that, right? Like, don't be doing these things. When you're a kid and you're doing all your firsts, first this, first that, whatever, you can't help it. Don't worry about that. You're going to do bad stuff. You're going to try stuff. It's, you know, do your best. It's what you do with that after that can lead to regrets, right?
Yeah.
It's if you continue to stay in the pattern of, you know, you start doing drugs at 16. If you're still doing drugs regularly all the time, that's not great. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to continue in that pattern as you continue on. So you have to focus on what regrets you are cool with and what you're not. Because the other thing is, you know, we don't live in a world where you can really be perfect. You can't.
No.
So you gotta find your ways, your little corners to be, to grow and also to, like, give yourself a break. Like, I'm like, you know what? I'm pretty overweight. I could be mad about it, but I'm gonna give myself a break about it. Like, there's plenty of other things that I've improved in my life, and maybe I'll improve this at some point before I go, but I'm not gonna stress about this right now because it just doesn't. Yeah. It's not going to help me to stress about it right now.
Well, and I think that questioning what people tell you, like, that's an essential part of one's own pattern development. So, for example, you mentioned drug use, like, as like a, you probably don't want to establish this as a constant part of your pattern.
Mm-hmm.
However, how many people do you know that drink coffee every day? They are on caffeine constantly. I was super straight edge for a while after college. And in college for that matter, but after college, I noticed I was getting headaches and I thought it might be caffeine withdrawals. And I thought to myself, like, I don't drink. I've stopped taking like even ibuprofen or anything. I'm super careful about what I put into my body, but I'm drinking like 3-4 cups of coffee before lunch without even thinking about it. And so like I took 2 years without having any coffee at all. And for a while, wasn't doing tea, wasn't doing cocoa, wasn't doing anything with a trace of caffeine in it. In part because I was like, why does my behavioral pattern say all of these drugs are off limits and this one I'm just doing wildly? I was frankly abusing it. I was abusing caffeine. I had an unhealthy relationship with caffeine. We just don't talk about it the way we do with alcohol or pot or Coke or what have you. And it's a stimulant, just like Coke. It's addictive. But we don't think about it. We don't talk about it.
Oh, yeah. I think about that with sugar, too. I have a unhealthy relationship with sugar.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite common. They're starting to talk more about the actual psychological effects of sugar and how it does have, like, not chemical dependency patterns the way that, like, heroin does or anything like that. But the psychological dependency. And like, I think that's part of why people enjoy sugar in their coffee as well, is the caffeine acts as a stimulant and the sugar gives you a quick burst of rapidly burnable energy. And the like milk, if you put milk in it, is heavy in fats and it's going to give you a slower burst of energy. And a lot of it is kind of resource management of I'm taking in this stuff that's going to stimulate me. It's going to accelerate my heart rate. It's going to make me want to move a little faster. And while I'm at it, I'm going to have this infusion of energy. I think there's a reason why our bodies pair those. And similarly with soda, right? Soda has a lot of sugar in it. It comes not only with the caffeine, it comes with the fuel to burn. Admittedly, a lot of them are high fructose corn syrup, which I've developed. But it's still there. The pairing is still there. You still burn it. It's still fuel at the end of the day. The fructose burns as readily as it does in an apple or a peach or a banana. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that it is fascinating, this discussion we got into kind of with reference to how we're choosing to live our lives. We started talking about this with this idea of like, you know, I was trying to figure out how to live and it led me down, you know, how should I do this? So to bring it back to sort of creative ideas, how have you worked your creative interests into your life, like when you got older? You mentioned you're in college, you know, you're doing you're straight edge. I don't know if that affects your hanging out with the theater crowd. Hard to tell. My theater experience was just clove cigarettes all the time, but
we would drink alcohol like after I was 20. I wasn't that straight edge, but I was not wheeling and dealing or wild by most measures. I was actually like, if there was any deviance, it was less chemical and more like vagabonding. I had 5 different friends who kept a toothbrush at their house because like you just never know where Steven's gonna sleep. I just like I would wind up anywhere and like, oh, this is where I am tonight. Especially I didn't have a car and I hated the bus system. So people would invite me over. I'm like, okay, but like, can you drive me back to campus in the morning? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. So I would keep one in my backpack. And then I had 5 different friends who kept a toothbrush at their place, even though I had my own like apartment, not my own. I had roommates, but like I had a place to stay, but I went vagabonding about. I stayed all over. It was a running joke from one of my roommates who was my roommate for like 4 years. I was there for 6. That like the best way to avoid me was to sign a lease with my name on it. Because it's the one place you knew I wasn't going to spend a lot of time was home.
Oh man, I really want to like delve deeper in that, but I feel like that'll lend us down a terrible rabbit hole that maybe we don't want to go down. So I'm going to say, what were you doing? Like, how were you bouncing from house to house? Were you guys all involved in, like, did you do theater in college? And so
I
you were
did.
like hanging out doing cast party stuff? Because I know with like theater people, the everybody sleeps in the living room on a pile of pillows happens a lot. You know.
Yeah. So there were a couple of things. I did do theater. I was a double major in chemical engineering and theater with an acting focus. Yeah.
Where did you go? What college allowed that?
Purdue University in Indiana. As I understand it, it was an unprecedented double major.
Ah.
Yeah. Though I did it, I had a friend who majored in physics and theater, which was also, as I understand it, an unprecedented double major. But yeah, I did both of those. And just wild hours, like credit hours. I had a couple 23 credit hour semesters. And took summer classes just to get done in 6 years, because there's not as much overlap between those two degree programs as one might hope.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
Yeah.
very surprising. I did
Yeah.
not
Right.
have any idea that there wouldn't be, you know, potentially a very serious, you know, Langston Hughes play about chemical engineering that you could, you know,
Yeah.
combo that.
Although I think Dolph Lundgren is a chemical engineer, if I remember correctly.
Sure. You
Yeah.
know.
But yeah, so in high school, I was very heavily involved in theater. I did a musical in eighth grade. Ninth grade, I didn't do theater or music or choir. And then in high school, I started getting involved with theater. Going into my senior year, I was the only person in my class who had done a single play, which was very interesting to me. Because no other class before or after me was like that. They all had like clusters of five, 10, however many. I was the only one going in to my senior year. Yeah.
How did they do a program if you were the only one? That's impossible.
Their grades, like the kids older than me, the kids younger than me, just no one my grade did it.
Wait, theater?
Yeah.
There was no one at Purdue University in
No, oh,
your
sorry. High school.
theater class.
High school.
Oh, I was like, are you
Doing
kidding me
plays.
right now? That is
No.
impossible for a department of a college to have no one in it.
Right.
I mean, don't
Right.
get me wrong. I went to a small college. There were six people in my graduating theater class. So I get small classes, but six was enough. You know.
No, yeah, in high school, there was going into senior year of high school, I was the only person who had done a play from the graduating class of 06.
Oh, so then when you got into college, though, they were certainly the people that you met doing theater in college were like, yeah, I've done plays before. It was just sort of
Yes.
unusual for your town.
And again, mostly for my grade. The kids younger than me, they'd have 5 or 10 people in their class of 150 who would do theater. The kids older than me, they'd have 5 or 10. My class, it was just me going into my, with two other people did a play my senior year. So all of three of us. But it was there in high school, I got admitted for chemical engineering. I had decided I want to do chemical engineering in seventh grade and then got into Purdue for that, or for their engineering program. And I was talking to my theater teacher and I was like, yeah, I mean, I love theater, but like, that's not really, what are you gonna do with it? You know, I'd like to eat. And my theater teacher was like, Steven, like I'm not gonna promise you're gonna be great, but you could eat. You're good enough that you could eat. I was like, oh, very exciting. So my freshman year, I applied to the theater program and started it my sophomore year, or my second year. It's hard to say freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, when I did 6 years and two degrees.
Sure.
Hard to line them up. I
Yeah.
like that I took two sophomore years and two junior years, though, so that I only had one senior year.
Sure. Yeah, sure. You want to just have that one final year. That year, though, must have been a weird year. Did you like finish one before the other in the 6 years, or like was
Nope.
your senior year just like super insane doing like all these engineering projects and like theatrical performances at the same time?
It was that one. But yeah, the latter of the two, just my counselor could not help me. They were not prepared to navigate, because the counselors were specific to college. Like each college at the university had their own counselors. So neither of them was prepared to help me schedule. But yeah, so I kind of sat down every year and I looked at the books and I had to plot it out well in advance. But yeah, college was when I got into the theater degree. It's also when I started performing improvisation seriously. My senior year of high school, we saw a group called the Ship of Fools at Purdue. And my best friend and I were already set to matriculate there. And he was like, "Hey, when we get to Purdue, I want to do this." And I was like, "Yeah, all right." It was short form, game-based, very Whose Line style. But they were really good. I really enjoyed watching them. And so when I matriculated, we went to the call out and I got involved there. And that probably even more than having my theater degree kicked off, not even probably, that really kicked off what it meant to be an adult performer for me.
Oh yeah, were there a lot of like adult performers of improv that you had in your that you like saw out of Purdue?
There were some like over the river. Purdue's in West Lafayette. Lafayette is on the other side of the river. There was a group called One Size Fits All, and they performed there. And then one summer, I took classes at Comedy Sports in Indianapolis, and so there were people not associated with the university. Naturally, everybody at Purdue, or at least, the vast majority, are technically adults. They're still in college, but they're all adults. And the performing branch, the Ship of Fools, ran the Purdue Improv Club. Joined the improv club, and it was a great way to meet people outside of at least chemical engineering. Still a lot of engineers, a surprisingly large number of engineers, and a shockingly small number of actors. Actors didn't like doing improv.
No, they don't.
No, I have a theory
They
on it.
still don't. Tell me why.
Yeah. I think that with actors, and certainly myself while I'm acting, there is a level of comfort I establish in how much blame can be placed on me. With acting, I can be like, "Ah, that director, ugh, this script, ugh, my scene partner, ugh, like bad day, something." There's a couple extra levels of protection on a bad performance. Whereas with improvisation, if it's a bad performance, like I can blame it on the audience, but like people start getting wise pretty quickly. If you're like, "Man, every audience is just bad," like, "Oh, maybe that's not the case." And I can blame my scene partner, but then nobody's going to want to play with me if I'm constantly like, "You messed up our scene." And so ultimately, more of the blame, or more of the pressure, even if it doesn't go wrong, more of the pressure feels like it's on the improviser. Because they have to come up with the words, they have to come up with the emotions, they have to come up with everything about it, and they have to do it very quickly. And I had a couple people confirm, like, "Yeah, no, that sounds horrifying. Like, I'll gladly get on stage and hit my mark on, the little X of glow in the dark tape. But to improvise is just, it's too naked. And there is a great deal of figurative nudity in performance, and there's a great deal of figurative nudity, especially in improvisation."
It's funny because in my mind I think of it almost exactly the opposite, and I think that's probably why in my life I tended toward improv, though I didn't know improv was a thing in high school or college like you did. I didn't find out it was a thing until I was 30. And I was like in New York when UCB was like starting, and I had no idea, right? But anyway, I was like, oh boy. But I wonder if it's like, for me personally, I get more nervous about having to honor somebody else's words, somebody else's idea. And don't get me wrong, I love sketch comedy. And I also am super open to the idea that sketch comedy has a tendency to become a little improv-y. Like, if you write sketch comedy and you're not, like, mostly cool with them getting the words mostly wrong, then you can't do this. Like, you cannot be a sketch comedy writer. You know what I mean? If you're like, you've got to say my exact words exactly the way, like Shakespeare, no, this is not where you need to be. Go write a play, get involved with that crowd, right? Mm-hmm. But like, so in that similar idea, it's like, for me, the scary part is not learning the lines. Memorization isn't the problem, but it's like, connecting with these words that this other person has chosen to use and like figuring out how to act it, not based on what I think, but based on what this other third party person is telling me to think. Like, hey guys, we're going to do this scene this way, you know? And so as I'm speaking, I'm realizing this is probably more my own control issues, but
whereas mine, it's the approval issues. Like, if there's an issue I have with doing scripted work, it's that often I wouldn't get any notes, so I had no idea how I did.
Yeah.
That was so anxiety-inducing. Like, I don't know people who get into theater because they want to be ignored. Like, that's not a thing. So to just, like, to do a show or to do a rehearsal and then, like, have no notes at all is just like, okay, I was there, though. Like, I did the thing.
Yeah, I hear that. Feeling. Yeah, plus it's such a weird thing, like, each director... Because, okay, so before I found improv, I personally did a lot of plays, but I didn't act in them. I was a stage manager for a long time. Oh, so okay. Most of my, like, learning how everything works was sitting there and taking notes and watching everybody else do it, which is fine. I'm fine with that. I'm organized.
If I may interject, are you saying that you were a stage manager just made me imagine you mentioned that you have a child. And so I just imagine you telling them like they need to take five and your kid barking back, thank you, five.
I wish. Man, he does not say that. I need to do that. I need to totally train my child to do that kind of thing.
It'd be great. Also, most people in public wouldn't get it, but the people who did would be thrilled. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just so tickled at the idea of, like, imagining me at 6 years old, precocious, looking for rings in the snow. Like, thank you, five.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, what's funny is I don't live my life that theatrically, I don't think. But then I don't know how the rest of the world lives, so maybe I do.
Yeah.
You know, and also stage manager, it sounds to me, it's almost surprising to me that you didn't get into stage management, because it sounds to me like organization has been key to most of your life. And navigating being, you know, having your creative pursuits of being an actor, doing improv, taking all these classes to get involved with that kind of thing, and also maintaining and getting a degree and now working in chemical engineering. Like, that's a career that you built on that side. And then you built another career on the other side. And like you mentioned, when it came to coming up with classes, that requires a little effort of putting that together. So, I mean, I think of my stage management, when I think of stage management, I think of what you had to do, what you do on a regular basis, putting together shows and doing your regular work. Earlier, you were telling me about these business meetings you're hosting. And I'm like, didn't we also talk about you hosting shows? Like this? So, like, the fact that you're doing all of these things, clearly you are very organized and you're like... are just on it.
I'm glad you feel like it, because I do not feel like I am. And a lot of biology in high school, I only took one class because they required me to keep like a very fastidious notebook, and it had to be like all in order. And it's like, this is terrible and I hate it. Organizing things is something I got good at, but it was not something I enjoyed needing to be good at, if that makes sense.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of people don't love the skill they're the best at, which is so sad, but it's true.
Yeah.
And you know, it kind of brings me back to what we were talking about earlier. It brings me back to what we were talking about earlier before we even were recording, which was the idea of like honoring the mistakes that we make. And like just now when I was like, I bet you people don't like they're the thing that they're the best at. They don't even love. I feel like it's that. You know what I mean? Like you probably are baller at organization because you have to be, right? Like you couldn't live your life without it.
Yeah, that may well be accurate.
But it's not something that you like are into, or you're like not going and seeking out books to read where you're like, how could I be a better organizer? You know, you're not like Marie Kondo, let's have a chat. Like it's not, you know, not that, but still.
But do I have five notebooks within reach? One that is an old dream journal, one that is my bullet notebook, and three of them that are lists for different areas of my life and the projects I need to execute on them within 6 inches of arm's reach. Yeah, I do have all of those, as well as a little altar to handwriting letters. But that's downstairs. But it's very like it.
Oh my God, same, all the details, same every detail. Like when we get off the podcast, I'm gonna send you a picture of the desk I'm sitting at right now, and it's just like just a pile of notebooks, and they all are for different specific things. Like I know what you mean, but I mean like how do you? Okay, so but you're a legit, like it's not like you got a chemical engineering degree and just didn't do it. And it's not like you did improv and then just were like, that was some funsies as a kid. You've maintained both of these things. How do you maintain both of these things?
By refusing to drop either of them is the long and short of it. Like,
don't quit.
Yeah, kind of. Like, I nearly dropped out of engineering because I did not like engineers. They were really competitive. They were, and I don't like competing. It feels bad. I don't like winning. I don't like losing. So.
Makes sense why you like long form improv versus short form improv now as well.
Well, actually my college group, one, I like both, but my college group did short form. But we didn't do it like comedy sports style. There wasn't much head-to-head. There were like tiny little moments, but the vast majority of it was cooperative. We were known as the Ship of Fools. We referred to each other as fools or the crew. And like we wrote little mythologies about each other. It was an extremely cooperative group. And so, yeah, while there were things like Do Run or Do Rap that had like elements of competition, so many of them, like Guessing Games, for example, that's pure cooperation. You know, your standard improv scenes, most of those are, actually I have a lot of philosophy about this. Entirely too many improv scenes are about interpersonal conflict performed standing 4 feet apart, just far enough away that if you like wave your hand in front of you, you can't hit the other person. Not close enough to come into contact by accident, and not far enough away for it to be like pointed and awkward. It's a very natural standing conversational place though, especially between people who are a little uncomfortable with each other, like coworkers. It's the either side of the water cooler distance.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, right. And there's just so many scenes that happen there. And it's fine. There's nothing wrong with an interpersonal conflict scene. There's nothing wrong with standing 4 feet apart. But we talked about patterns earlier. At a certain point, if you're not doing anything else, it's not even a pattern anymore. It's just a constant. And so when I started teaching the seven types of conflict was a major part of level three I designed, I want to say. Might have been level two. I don't remember. I taught the last level. I taught level five, which was development of group and individual voice, which didn't have a curriculum. It was, I sat with a group and I created a curriculum tailored to them every time. for their graduate, for their final level, for their graduating class. So the other ones, I get a little mucky on what happens where.
It's okay.
But yeah,
we don't need the syllabus right now. Tell me about the, tell me about the seven types of conflict improv class. Like, how did you come up with that, and how did it serve your students?
Well, I came up with it because I was bored. So it's the long and short of it. Is I kept seeing, like I said, these interpersonal conflicts. These, like, I'm mad at you because you stole my gummy bears. Yeah, well, I love gummy bears, so whatever. And I was like, no, this is, like, it's fine, but I want more. And ultimately, part of what I did as a teacher was, one, try to pass on the skills I have, but also to shape the community in a direction that I thought was worth going in, which to some degree means I had to shape it to my taste. I also taught people to do stuff I didn't enjoy watching. Yeah, the seven types of conflict class, we would list them essentially, which are person versus person, person versus self, which is my favorite, person versus God, person versus nature, person versus the supernatural, which is debatably different from God, and God can also be time, person versus machine, and person versus society, right? Those are your seven. And we would do a couple different things with it. One of my favorite exercises we would do in the class is I would have somebody do a line and motion initiation of a scene. So you would take a step, sit down, say one line, something like that. And we would choreograph it so that they could deliver it the same every time. Every time they started the scene, it was the exact same. And I would list my seven types of conflict on the board, and I would have seven people leave the room and the rest of the class would just watch. And each person who walked in would be given the choreographed scene initiation, and then they would respond and they would play out a scene. And I'd ask the class what was the type of conflict, and we'd scratch it out. And we would keep going until the same initiation had been run through all seven types of conflict, in part because I think it's really important to, a lot of people tell you not to think in improv, but also that's a facade. Like, you can't not think. That's not a, that's death. That's being dead. but you can change the way you think. You can change, and I think of it as splitting my mind, right? Like, I will make choices that are still in character, but are being guided by a director, if that makes sense. And teaching someone to live more than one life at a time on stage is fun. And it gives them more power, and it gives them the power to break their habits, right? And habit breaking is a huge part of what I wanted to teach. Is like, yes, you are naturally inclined to some things, but like, one of the great things about improv is how exploratory it can be, both in terms of the type of media you're making, but also like personally. I've joked around that one of my favorite things about improv is I get to make bad life choices. Like, one show I had is called Like-Minded People, and we would bring a stranger onto stage, and the way we took a suggestion is we would make sustained silent eye contact, and we would take in, I don't know if this happens with everybody, some people will hear this and they'll be like, yeah, that makes sense, and some people it won't make sense, but you just stare silently into somebody's eyes, and whenever I do that, there's a part of my brain that's like, hey, this is really going on for a while. Do we love this person? Is that what this is? Like, are we in love right now? And the premise for me was to say yes. And I would look in somebody's eyes and I would explore all of the potential of what it would be like, not even necessarily to romantically love the person, but like, who would we be? What is our relationship? Is it romantic? Is it non-romantic? Watching their body shift in the periphery. Are they comfortable with me? What are our struggles moving forward to have a friendship, a romance, a marriage, a parent-teacher relationship, whatever it is, something long and sustained? What would I and this person be? And just kind of explore all of that. And the show, because of the way the suggestion was taken, often involved often wound up being a mono scene, even though it wasn't necessarily supposed to be a single scene for 25 minutes. It happened a lot. And it was often either very old friends or romantic partners. And so my duo partner would say something, and like I'd make real snippy cuts and jabs and like say things that if we were actually a couple would be hurtful and what, like, just not appropriate. But I certainly don't feel comfortable doing that in my real life. There's super big repercussions for that, for hurting people, or for flying off the handle. And I know I mentioned my childhood a bit earlier. My relationship to my own anger is not one of indulgence by any means, just because I've seen where anger goes when it is indulged. And so, like, being able to express dissatisfaction in a relationship, even on stage, and doing it in ways that, like, I know are not the best ways to do them in real life. Like, there's a lot of catharsis there. And I think ultimately the goal of theater is catharsis. And I think it's both for the actor and for the audience. We're providing catharsis. I think a lot of people don't think the point of comedy is catharsis. And I think they're wrong.
Are you kidding me? Laughter is literally catharsis. Like, it's the physical embodiment of catharsis.
I think I agree. At least one form of it. I don't know about you. How many shows have you had where you're like, it was mostly really funny, and then there was like one serious kind of sad scene, and afterward, like, you had a surprising number of audience members be like, wow, that one real sad scene. Ooh, that was real sad. Like, it's the one that they pick out, and it's the one that they hold on to. I often refer to catharsis as the heartworm pill, and we wrap it in comedy to make it appealing. The audience comes, they're like, yeah, I'm going to laugh. It's going to be real funny. But what we as humans need out of those moments is not just laughter. Otherwise, they'd stay home and tickle each other or something, right? Laughter's not enough. It's not enough just to laugh. What I think we ache for, but don't always have the ability to say, or the either we don't have the words for it, we don't recognize it, or we're too scared to ask for it sometimes, is catharsis. And that by framing theater in comedy, we make it palatable, right? Not everybody wants to go see Women of Troy and watch just trauma on stage. But you deal a little bit with trauma in a comedy, you deal with hardship and loss in a comedy. And another thing, and we're a lot more open to it. I've also referred to comedy or humor as oven mitts, right? It allows us to handle things that aren't safe to touch directly. One of my first introductions to dark humor, admittedly, but some of my earliest humorous memories dealt with one of my sisters passed when I was 9. And a lot of other people were uncomfortable with my family making jokes. But it was also essential. Like, it was essential. What is the name of that song where I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral? Like, all of us laugh at funerals, or at least, like, afterward. Right. Ideally, at a funeral, at some point you start reminiscing and you remember a good time and you share a laugh about the person who's gone. I wouldn't want to go to a funeral or a mourning service with someone that I was close to where, like, we couldn't find a moment to laugh. That would be a different kind of heartbreaking. Right. And I'm not saying everybody has to laugh at funerals. I think it's healthy. Not ubiquitous, but there's nothing wrong with it, and we have these taboos about it. Enough that, like I said, it gets called out in pop culture as like, oh, laughed at a funeral. Yeah, whether at the funeral or like grabbing a drink with people afterward or whatever it is, laughter, like you said, it is the manifestation of catharsis. It is a good part of the grieving process and a good part of processing all manner of emotions, not just happiness or silliness.
Yeah, totally.
How many
times? The reason why funerals are funny, and usually the go-to, like if you're starting, when I teach sketch comedy, it's a location immediately.
Oh yeah.
It's like first sketch, it's always a funeral, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just because, you know, for me, when I teach comedy, it's all about the contrast. I'm like, what will be a weird place for this conversation to happen? And they're like, it would be super weird for it to happen at a funeral. Yeah, it would.
You're right.
It would. It's not cool to have this conversation there. And we're all aware that it's not cool.
Right.
Because we're aware it's not cool, we can establish, we can put this here. And we are all acknowledging together, we get it. This shouldn't happen, but we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're making those bad life choices. This is not the right place, but it is where it's going to happen. Making the wrong choices, I think a very good way to improvise is like, nope, this is not the right choice. This is it's the wrong one. This is a bad choice. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Because you're safe to do it there. Like,
again, I also argue that comedy characters are terrible people. Like, they're not going to learn a lesson. They're not coming out of this a better. They're going to continue to slip on that banana peel over and over. And no one, at no point are they going to be like, you know what, I should probably look down and pick up this banana peel. They're not going to do it. And if they did, boo. Ruins comedy. Right? Like, no.
Yeah.
So bad life choices is essentially what comedy is.
Yeah, and low repercussions, right?
Yeah.
In a tragedy, you pay your debts. A comedy, you can borrow money, go out on the town, be wild. And we're not going to see you actually have to pay your debt, or certainly we're not going to see the long-term repercussions of it, right? Maybe you go to, like, debtor's prison right as the lights fade. But we're not going to see you suffering, trying to remember why you thought it was a good idea to spend a small fortune over the course of a weekend.
Probably. Yeah, but even like in plays, even like in a Shakespeare play where somebody's like borrowing too much money, somehow there's a person near the end where they're like, turns out the governor decided to give him a pardon. And you're like, what? But that's how it is in like so many movies. You know what I mean?
Especially with a comedy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this guy drove a car through 16, you know, businesses, but we're fine with it. It's cool.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, no. Not really. But in comedy, in these fun stories that we're creating. So, speaking of fun stories that we're creating, tell me about the performances, the shows that you're working on right now. I know we talked a little bit offline about one of the shows that you're doing, but like, tell me, what's your jam right now? Like, what are you working on? What are you putting out theatrically?
Yeah, very gladly we'll share about that. So this is my second theater company I'm working with, Pronoia Theater. And we're actually being super aggressive about coming up with new ideas. It's a little annoying, because we're doing shows right now every Thursday, and we're full up, and our rotation doesn't allow for us to do all of the things that we've done. And we're like, oh, we got to do more of that. There's just not room. We can't. But yeah, so every Thursday we're doing a show. 2 out of 4 Thursdays is our podcast that we call Public Production Meeting. It's also a webcast. We do it live video and then cut it down for the audio feed. But it's about what it's like to produce small independent theater on a shoestring budget, basically. Like you said, the purpose of this in part is to let people know that how many different paths there are. There aren't a lot of resources out there for people wanting to produce small independent theater, especially if it's like not a nonprofit. We don't get any money from anybody other than donations. And so we talk about what our process is like. How do we write a sketch? How do we train improvisers? How do we... one of our major projects right now, we do once a month, and it's about an hour, 15-minute episode of a show that we're calling Space Train, which is a piece that takes place in space on an intergalactic train and follows seven different characters. And so, you know, we talk about how do we go from... We started with just two characters originally. Boris, the mild-mannered nuclear engineer who runs the space train, and Professor Ratskull, who is my character, and he's a nasally mad scientist. And this is all we really started out with, was the name Space Train. Boris, who, like I said, very mild-mannered, just you know, you're down-home, blue-collar nuclear engineer. Very unassuming character. And then Professor Ratskull, who is this melodramatic would-be villain, thinks he's very scary. This is where we started, and now we're doing, like I said, an hour or more of content a month. And so how do we go from those characters, develop the other ones, go from very rough idea to an outline for a script, to writing a script, to editing that script, casting, et cetera. We've covered a bunch of that stuff. And it's really interesting to me. Yeah. It's the ambitious project I think I've done, certainly in terms of writing, the most ambitious project I've done.
Now that's like a Zoom show, right?
Yeah, yeah. We live stream it on our website, paranoiatheater.com/live, as well as our Facebook page, once a month.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. And then I know, what is it, next week? We're going to be doing Magical Lying Hour, which is another one of our major shows. It's been our flagship show since, our flagship improvised show since before quarantine. And that is a show in which we take an actor and we have them memorize half of a script. If folks are familiar with Actor's Nightmare as a short form game, this is similar to that, except we do 12 to 15 minute scenes. I've done a 30 plus minute scene once, but that is quite uncommon. But the actor memorizes the script, and then you introduce an improviser who knows nothing about the script and knows nothing about what's going to be going on. And they improvise and negotiate space and the narrative with the scripted party. The scripted party is required to deliver all of the words in order. That's basically the one rule they really have. They can change inflection, they can change punctuation, they can split lines up, they can combine lines, but all of the words are supposed to be in order. Yeah, and that's we're going to be doing that with folks from the Nursery Theatre in London. They invited us for a show. We had them on for a Saturday morning show a while back. And they reached out to have us perform with a bunch of their improvisers. So we'll be providing American actors to British improvisers here soon. And yeah, that's our other really major one in terms of, like, that's it. Magical Lying Hour is, as far as I know, Houston's most traveled improv show. And that's, yeah, it's a ton of fun. My co-producer does just in what feels like an insurmountable amount of work. I get to be the improviser, and he does all of the cuttings, and I don't get to know what any of the scripts are because I don't know what I'm going to be improvising against. So he, for these online shows, for example, we've been doing five different scenes of about 12 minutes each, and he's reading dozens of plays, cutting them down to scenes that can be run for 12 minutes. Most of them could probably be run for half an hour, but we stop before the end of the script. And it, you know, casting it, rehearsing the actors, rehearsing the improvisers, all manner of stuff. It's pretty neat. We aren't doing memorized while we're on Zoom though, which allows us to do it more frequently. Yeah. And also lowers the commitment from the actor, right? Memorizing a script to work with someone who's improvising once is it's a lot to ask of an actor. We definitely want to respect their time very thoroughly.
Yeah, totally. When you say that it's Houston's most traveled improv show, do you mean like people across the world have seen it because it's on Zoom?
No. I mean that due to festivals and such. I believe we have performed in more either cities or minimally more, what is the term he uses? Like television locales? those sections. I forget how he's tracked it, but my co-producer, my business partner, my dear, dear friend, Aaron Garrett, is the one who was tracking that. We started... Yeah, Aaron Garrett and I are the co-owners of Pronoia Theater, and we do all of our productions together. We started working together 2015, I want to say. He was originally a student of mine who then graduated, and like we really respected each other's work, and then it grew into inviting each other to work on different projects and then eventually forming our own theater in a more overt fashion, a legal entity beyond ourselves.
How long have you been doing Pronoia Theater?
Legally, I think about 2 years. It had different names, but I've been working with him since, like I said, about 2015. But the term Pronoia is about 2 years old. He and I have been partners for roughly that long. I'm very bad at tracking time and history. I think it's one of the things that helps me improvise is I just have no awareness of the past beyond what's going on.
That's helpful. So thank you so much for chatting with me on the podcast. One final question I wanted to ask you is if you had any advice for people who, somebody who wants to follow a similar path to you, maybe they want to work in engineering and do theater, or maybe they want to do small independent theater. What, based on your life experience, what advice do you have for people hoping to do what you're doing?
Other people can only tell you how to be like them, I think would be kind of the nugget of it. Like, you can ask me for advice if you want to be like me, and I can, like, by all means, I mentioned, like, just refuse to do less. Don't force other people to make you choose, because you don't have to. You're allowed to be as passionate and thorough about your hobby or second career as you want to be. But also make sure you develop your voice. What is it that you want to be doing? Even if you like what I do or if you think what I'm doing is neat, eventually you're going to have to assert your own voice, because mine will always be mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, finding your own space, finding your way of doing it. Even it, borrowing things from other people, absolutely. But in the end, it has to be yours.
There's something empowering about that and frightening at the same time. I know people, you know, as they're starting, you know, it's when the big advice is like, just be yourself, find your own voice. And finding your own voice is super, super hard. But
yeah.
But I think you're right that, you know, at the end of the day, you make a decision on what you think is important. And, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what your mentors say or your theater teachers or whatever person who's advising you, you have to make your own decision. And that's your way of living in the world.
Yeah. And by all means, listen to your teachers, listen to everyone, listen to anyone and weigh how much you value their advice. And also how much you weigh your own thoughts, how much you weigh your confidence in the decision you want to make, because you're allowed to disagree with everyone.
Oh, man. Stephen, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me. Thank you for sharing stories. And boy, we went down some sweet philosophical rabbit holes, which I really enjoy. I think we may have solved the universe. It's happened.
Nice. I look forward to the next one.
The next universe?
Yeah. Just to be clear. Yeah. Why
not? Oh, man, you're funny. Oh, well, thanks for doing it, and thanks for being part of the whole experience.
Very gladly. Thank you for having me on.
You're funny.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.